For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
That's kind of appropriate music for somebody that lives in Georgia. Joining me is the one and only Alex Hollins. What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm not bad. How are you?
You know what? I've been gone for a couple weeks, so I got home yesterday, and got home late Saturday night, and then hung out in my house yesterday, did some yard work, unpacked, so it was a good day. I'm not going to lie to you. I enjoyed it.
There's nothing better than coming back home after being on the road for a while. It's the best feeling in the world.
Right?
Something about your couch, you know?
Yeah. You're like looking in your refrigerator that doesn't have any food and your cupboards that don't have any food.
But they're yours, you know?
But they're your empty cupboards. Yeah. And you're looking at your lawn that's grown too high and needs to be edged, but it's yours. So.
I am embarrassed to admit that I actually paid a guy to mow my lawn this past week.
You're a loser. You're a loser.
I know. Well, you know, I didn't expect the grass to grow this fast. I haven't bought a lawnmower since moving into this new house.
And, yeah.
You know, I didn't want to get on the HOA's bad side because I'm assuming they have some kind of power to, like, put me in jail or punish me somehow.
Well, let me tell you, there's nothing that looks more suspicious in the South than long grass because you know what comes with that. That's right.
No, what comes with that? What
there's
comes
a with whole the there's a whole series of first there's long grass. Then there's a pickup truck on blocks right in the front yard.
You're saying the South, but this sounds like my front yard growing up in Vermont too. It was a Camaro, not a pickup truck.
We're changing oil in the front yard and not really worrying about an oil pan. So it's just, you know, then there's dead carcasses of animals hanging on a cyclone fence in the backyard.
I will say, for anybody who's ever played the Fallout series of video games, there are large swaths of Georgia that look like that post-apocalyptic wasteland. It seems like here in Georgia, sometimes people just move out of houses and then they just forget about them. They just like let them, just give them back to nature. Just overgrown, falling apart. I've never seen so many houses with collapsed roofs than I have in this area. Like, the video game, you know, guy in me, like, feels like I need to go and explore every one of these, like, rubbled houses because there's some legendary quest item in there that I have to go find, but I've never actually gone into one because I'm assuming they'll collapse.
That's probably a good thing. Just remember, those are video games, okay? Those are video games. And much like John Wayne, who never actually fought in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam...
Or knew how to ride a horse for the first portion of his career,
or who never served in the Marine Corps. Reality is a little bit different than the fantasy part.
Come on, though. If we're going to give John Wayne a hard time for anything, it has got to be playing Genghis Khan.
No, it's to it's avoiding military service in World War II because he was a movie star, because he claimed he had to support his family, and then when the war ended, he divorced his wife.
That's pretty gross.
That's pretty gross. Yeah, right? I know the Duke is legendary, but come on, man. Everybody, even Joe DiMaggio, who was a total piece of shit as a human being, right? He even served in World War II because he said, yeah, even losers like me can't, like, I can't not do this.
L. Ron Hubbard served in World War II. I mean, he didn't do anything of use or value, but... But at least he was there. I'll give him a little bit of credit for showing up.
Yeah, they like, hey, man, it's like you're treading a total piece of shit land if you don't go to this one. And John Wayne didn't go.
Yeah, that's pretty gross. I'll admit that. He got me there. That's pretty gross.
And again, I know, he's on our posters and shit, but my point is this, Alex. Don't go marauding through the desolation of Georgia looking for something that's in a video game, because just remember, it's a video game.
That sounds exactly like somebody who wants to get the legendary glowing sword for themselves. So you're just trying to keep me off the trail.
You know what? I don't need the legendary glowing sword because I have a pair of brand new Beats headphones.
All right, so you're pretty baller over there. That's fair.
I'm straight up baller.
That's a legendary quest item in our line of work. That's pretty good.
Well, you know what? I thought that I should... normally, the headphones I use for this program they cost $19 at Best Buy. They're Sony's, and I'm not proud of it. But because normally you blow through them. And then I thought, you know what? I do this for much of my day, and so I probably should get a good pair of headphones. So I went to the PX at Camp Lejeune. I'm looking at headphones. I said, well, what's the difference between this, 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 and this? And they were telling me. And I said, okay, I'll take those. And I have to tell you, they're noise-canceling headphones. Now, I don't know.
Are they as good as the hype? I mean, you see Beats in every music video on the planet. I've never worn a pair.
Yeah,
are they as good as they're supposed to be?
Okay, so that's what I wanted. That's what I was curious about. So I get on the plane flying from – I get delayed out of Jacksonville, and I finally get to Charlotte. I miss my connection, so I get put on another flight. I'm flying Charlotte to LAX as opposed to Orange County. So the guy I'm sitting, though, next to is going – he's a drummer, and he's going to go play at Coachella. So –
I worked security at Coachella 1 year, and you couldn't pay me enough to go back.
That's what he said. He said it's a little bit different. But anyway, so he's from Puerto Rico, and he's playing for a couple bands that played there yesterday. And he said one of them has a robot that sings. I don't know. He's like, and he shows me a picture of it. He said, and there's, like, the robot's on stage, but I'm not. I'm in an acoustic room off stage, right, with my headset on, and I'm just playing. And I'm watching them, like, on a screen, but it's just, I'm like...
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So, we're talking about headphones, and he's showing me, he's got these $60 ones that look like they're molded to your ear, like musicians use, but he said they're not. And so I said, well, I just got these. He said, oh, I've never used them. So, So I bust them out on the plane, and I was listening to music. Now, between the Airbus 321, which is incredibly quiet, and because I was, they shifted my ticket, right? So I'm flying on a military fare back to the coast. Normally you're in the back, right, in steerage with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet in the bottom of the Titanic.
Does the seatbelt actually attached to the bathroom door?
Exactly. And you're behind the engine, so acoustically it is louder. I think it's louder back there. So
it is actually the safest place to be in an airplane if it goes down, though.
Yeah,
statistically speaking.
You're talking about living on the island of the damned, okay? So anyway, so now I'm sitting in row 7, right? Plenty of leg room, and I put my noise-canceling headphones on, and I look out the window, and I thought I was Aladdin on a magic carpet.
Aladdin, like, with no leg room, though, right? Like,
no, I had leg room.
Were you in an exit row or something?
No. If you sit, the further north you sit in the plane, the more legroom you have. If you sit back in steerage, you're back there cramped in like a car, like a sardine.
Oh, my mistake. You got upgraded. Okay, yes, my mistake. I thought you were still back there where I normally fly.
No, I'm in business class.
Where I'm trying to sit Indian style and hug my knees.
Right. You're like, I'm reclining like a plantation owner. Right? like I'm a sugar beet plantation owner in Jamaica, like I'm king of rum. And and I have my noise counseling headphones on, and I look out the window, and I said, I think I'm not sure, but I might be flying on a magic carpet. And that's the sensation I had. That's, you hear nothing.
I've got to say, I'm impressed. I'm surprised to hear that they really do live up to the hype, because although I'll say that's how I became a Glock guy, was the same thing. As I saw Glocks everywhere, heard about them from everybody, but I was a 1911 guy through and through. And then I picked one up because it was a Gen 3 Glock 19 on sale on clearance, you know, because the Gen 4s had just come out. And I was like, what the hell, man, it's $300, I'll give it a try. And fell in love with it. I was immediately like, oh my God, it turns out people were right. These are great guns. You know, I still love my 1911. But every once in a while, I'm surprised when things do live up to the hype. It seems like more often than not, they don't, you know?
Well, you know what? Glock is, you know, and you'll meet people like Alex that they were 1911, out of my cold, dead hand, you'll pry that some bitch.
That was me. It was, you know? And I'll say this. I'm a big believer in the right tool for the job, right? And in my opinion, a Glock is like a Honda Accord. It will start every time you turn the key. It's always going to do what you ask it to do, but it may not necessarily be the sexiest thing around, you know?
It used to be
the gun Fox Mulder carries.
It used to be, though. It used to be the sexiest thing, because remember when they came out, it's like, that's a Glock.
Plastic.
Yeah. It's a Glock. It's not metal. What's going on?
But
would it even work?
I didn't like it, you know? Because I was like, it's freaking plastic. I don't want that. You know, but I got to say, now my Glock 19, that Glock 19 is nothing left from Glock, except maybe the slide is still original. But everything else I've just kind of replaced over years. But I think that's the same thing you do with a Honda Accord, you know? If you like your Honda, you end up replacing most of the Honda parts with other stuff, you know? But my 1911 is still the way it was when it came out of the box. And honestly, I'm still a better shot with it than I am with my Glock.
That thing's a pig, too. I mean, those things, if you're a good shot with a 1911, because that's a, you know, that's a man's weapon. That is not, you're not going to steer that bullet any place close to the target unless you're a man, because the recoil on that thing.
I'll admit, the recoil on the .45 versus the 9mm is noticeable, you know. But, I mean, I've also got a Taurus Judge over here that shoots shotgun shells that I bought for no reason other than I wanted a gun that shoots shotgun shells, like a pistol that shoots shotgun. It was literally like, oh, that's neat. I could fight Bigfoot with that. The word is that it's an excellent snake gun for hiking, which I'm sure it would be if I ever carried it hiking. It's like, I'm not going to carry a brick of a gun in my pack just in case I run into a snake.
You're rolling around hiking with a sawed-off shotgun?
No, it's a pistol. It's a Taurus Judge public defender. So it's actually a polymer revolver pistol that shoots 410 gauge shotgun shells, or, you know, some real big 45 long Colt solid rounds. It's a nasty gun. It is a nasty gun, but it doesn't serve any real practical purpose. I'm sure there's people out there who are like, I love my Taurus Judge. I can't think of any actual reason to have one of these, other than just that it was cool, you know? I started out when I was buying guns, like, kind of with that three-gun mindset. You need a good primary weapon, like an assault rifle. You need a shotgun and a sidearm. You know, that's the three-gun approach. And I was like, once you have those three guns, you don't need any more guns. You know, you've got one gun for every, you know, practical application. And then I bought those three guns, and I was like, yeah, but what if Bigfoot came? If I had to fight Bigfoot, I don't know how well these things would do. I would need some kind of a pistol that shoots shotgun shells. You know, and then a little I had
that
an AR.
That actually went into your head?
Well, no, that was really more how I justified it to my wife. I just wanted a gun, another gun. You know, so just the same way I ended up buying an AK a few years later was that I had an AR for a long time.
Right.
And I love my AR. It's a fantastic platform.
Right.
And again, just like my Glock, you know, nothing that's in it, you know, came stock with it because I like to tinker. And then I saw an AK for a good deal and was like, I don't have any practical use for an AK-47.
Of course not.
But it is a good deal.
So how do you, how do I pass that up?
Yeah, you know, and altogether, so now I've got a bunch of guns. I would argue the vast majority of them have no actual practical use other than just having a good day with my buddies on a Sunday, laying them all out on a picnic table and blowing up some watermelons.
Is that not a practical use?
Hey, yeah,
let me tell
agree.
You, is it wrong to have guns that you just use with your buddies to go have fun with?
I agree with you completely. I am not that. I am a big believer in home defense and self reliance, but I'm not that guy who will contend that I need all of the firearms I have to protect my family. I have enough firearms in my house to arm a platoon. I can't carry that many guns, you know? I don't have that many.
Yeah,
but
you have a daughter now.
More than I need.
You have a daughter now. She can carry a few.
Well, you know, and I have a Chiapa little Badger. That's a .22 single shot breech loader you know, when she's a little bit older, that's going to be what I teach her on.
And she's she's certainly probably got a wagon, so you could throw a few in the wagon and she
could
pull
them. Throw a few in the wagon, you know?
Yeah.
But the real reason why I have most of the guns that I have is for the same reason why, you know, you've got that buddy with a Camaro in the garage. You know, I enjoy tinkering with it. I like taking them apart and cleaning them. I like taking them out on the weekend with my friends and having fun. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, we don't need to pretend that I'm preparing for World War III or the apocalypse for me to just be, you know, happy in the fact that I enjoy my firearms, you know?
All right, here's a question for you. Text message. What about a throwdown gun?
Now, I carry a Ruger LCP, which is chambered in .380.
Okay, hold on. Could you explain to everybody what a throwdown gun is?
Well, it's like your backup emergency firearm. You know what I mean? Like, let's say you're carrying a Glock 19 on your hip and a concealed carry holster. Some guys like to have what they call a throwdown gun or a secondary firearm. Sometimes it's in an ankle holster, but a lot of people aren't big fans of ankle holsters. I think that in the right circumstances, you could probably find a use for one. I've never worn one. Actually, I take that back. I wore an ankle holster one time while touring a prison with a group of strangers that I had never met before. One of them was CAG, one of them was CIA, and three of the other ones had no names or agencies that I had been told about. And one of the guys was a former Green Beret. And I was like, I don't know any of these guys. This prison doesn't have electricity, let alone cell service. So I carried my little LCP in an ankle holster in my under my khakis.
Now, hold on. I thought a throwdown gun is one that police carry when some shit goes on and somebody's shooting at somebody and we're not sure if he had a weapon or not, and we throw our weapon down.
That's not the throwdown gun that I'm familiar with. I'm familiar with a throwdown gun as, like, your emergency backup weapon.
And you would be wrong, okay? I think what we're talking about.
If you're looking for a gun to throw on a body, obviously it's a High Point. Obviously it's a High Point, which I actually own. I own a High Point 9mm. I bought it for $50 to review, and it is every bit as bad as you've heard. It's the worst gun I have ever fired in my entire life. The magazine falls out at random intervals. It jams, I would say, every third or fourth round.
But if you had to throw it down, you wouldn't feel bad about that.
No, that's fair. Yeah, I would be happy. I could... If it weren't for my fear that a child would find it, I could throw this gun out the window without any hesitation.
Right.
It weighs about the same as my Glock 19 does with a 21-round magazine and a flashlight.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is the quintessential question about throwdown guns. Is your gun registered?
Well, Georgia doesn't have any registration requirements.
What?
So none of my firearms.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
It's one of the reasons why I live in Georgia.
Yeah, no kidding.
I like Georgia's gun laws. It was definitely one of the things that went into play. Moving from Massachusetts, I moved to Massachusetts from California. So when it came time for me to relocate again, I really wanted a place where I didn't have to jump through hoops just to keep the firearms I already owned.
Yeah, but I mean, no gun registration in the state?
Well, answer me this. Of what value is gun registration? Tell me what the purpose behind registering, so like, let's say I own six guns.
Yes.
What value does the state have in me giving you a list of exactly what six guns I have other than coming to take them? Outside of that, what purpose could it possibly serve?
Is this a trick question?
No, this is my sincere question about gun registration.
If
you want me to register my firearms with you, what benefit does it serve our society other than you presuming that you'll need to come and take them away?
I can control that which I know exists. So I guess if I was going to make the case for it, I would say I can control something that I need. Here's from a cop. I am correct. Make sure you tape the handle real good. No prints.
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't want to tell you that came from a law enforcement officer, but it might have. I'll have to think about that.
Gun legislation is that I'm not against gun control in every form. I think background checks are a perfectly logical step. I think that we don't invest properly into the infrastructure of our background check system, and that's why it doesn't work.
Well, let me tell you, we have recent history, right, to prove that.
Yeah. The Department of Defense has clearly demonstrated an inability to accurately convey information to the background check database to make sure that people who have been convicted in a military trial of something that should bar them from owning a firearm, that information is not reaching the background check database. As one example of ways that we can fix the laws that we have in place instead of passing new laws without worrying about fixing the old ones. I think the first thing we should do, I'm not saying no new laws should ever be put into place,
but
the first thing we should do is make sure that the laws in the books are working properly. Make sure that we're investing in them appropriately so that they have an opportunity to be successful. Instead of just, crumpling it up, assuming it's as good as it's going to get and throwing it away and moving on to banning the AR-15, which doesn't serve any practical purpose because there are a million other semi-automatic rifle platforms available to the consumer out there, many of which don't look scary like an AR-15, but are just as or deadlier. If you're carrying a semi-automatic 30-06, that'll blow a way bigger hole in you than an AR-15. It fires at the same firing rate, but it looks like your dad's hunting rifle with a magazine. So people aren't as scared of it, So what we need is when people say common sense gun reform, I think genuinely we need common sense gun reform. We need to think about the things
that will actually have
an appreciable effect.
And we know there's abundance of that.
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
When we start talking about guns in this country. So on that
what
note,
what ends up happening is guys like me are the minority because most 2A guys won't give you an inch because on the other side, people who are for really strong gun control, they'd rather see, for instance, assault weapons, gathered back up by the government and destroyed. Because there are people on the extremes of either side, the arguments we get in the popular media tend to be those extremes, as is the case with all things.
Got it.
Right?
All right. That was the buzzer. You wrote an op-ed in Newsrip, The Truth About Reservists Following the Deaths of Three Reserve Marines in Afghanistan. Obviously, we all saw that last week, and if you read more about them, they were supposed to come home within, 10 days of when they were killed. And so talk to me, the op-ed, what was the opinion that you were expressing in the op-ed?
Well, what really struck me when I first, you know, because obviously I covered those three Marines that died soon after it happened. They were all from 25th Marine Regiment, which is the Marine Regiment that I was on the inspector instructor staff for before getting out of the Marine Corps. For those of you who may not be familiar, the inspector instructor staff are effectively the active duty skeleton crew assigned to a reserve unit to train them. When you say inspector instructor, the idea is supposed to be that you're inspecting them to make sure that they're MOS proficient. An instructor is really that you're fulfilling, you know, the annual training requirements and things like that. On paper, the relationship between the active duty staff and the reserve staff at an INI command is really that the reserve command is supposed to train their own Marines, they're supposed to lead their own Marines, and we're supposed to be there in support. But the truth is, obviously, that it's a joint effort, right?
Right.
The active duty Marines and the reserve Marines have to work together to get anything done. And it was my experience that, you know, on the active duty side, we tend to, you know, we rib on our reserve counterparts quite a bit, you know what I mean? We call them weekend warriors.
Right.
If you'll excuse, this is a really crass thing, but, you know, we'll call them tampons because you only use them once a month. We tend to give them a really hard time. The truth of the matter is some of the most dedicated Marines I have ever met were in the reserve component code. You know, a number of them were prior active duty that had, you know, finished their 4 years or their 8 years or their 12 years. And they were done with being an active duty Marine, but they wanted to find a way to continue to serve their country, to continue to participate, you know. And but I'll be honest, I met a fair number of really, really good Marines, just genuinely good Marines, that were reserved right from the get-go, you know. They really, the ideas of honor, courage, and commitment, you know, rang true for them. It didn't matter that they only wore camis 2 days a month. It didn't matter that they only went to annual training for 2 weeks a year. These guys would use their vacation time to come help us with pre-deployment workups for, you know, one of our companies. These guys would come out. As I've mentioned before, I worked funeral honors and next of kin notifications for years. And a lot of times when you have a funeral honors ceremony, if it was an active duty Marine or a retiree, they rate a full honors funeral, which requires a minimum of 11 Marines present. You know, on an INI staff, that might be the entire staff. You might have to have, you know, the major or the colonel come out to support that, unless, you know, you've got really committed reserve Marines that are willing to come in on a day that they're not required to drill, you know, wearing their dress blues uniform, which is not a particularly warm uniform, wearing core frames in 3 feet of snow, standing there for 4 hours at the position of attention just to make sure that these families know how important the sacrifice that we're honoring was to the Marine Corps as a whole. And as a result to us, you know, we're there representing the Marine Corps and the nation, right? You know, these Marines, for me, you know, the 4 years that I spent doing funerals, I probably worked three or four funerals a week over the span of 3 or 4 years. I worked a lot of funerals, and I would argue a solid 80% of them, I had reserve Marines standing right there beside me helping to bury these heroes. And so then when you hear about reservists dying in a country like Afghanistan, in a war that our country, by and large, doesn't care about anymore. You know, when you write stories about what's going on in Afghanistan, it's really difficult to get any traction under that story. People just don't click. They don't care, you know. And these guys were out there doing what the country asked of them. You know, the country asked them to serve, asked them to deploy to a combat zone, to an area that's by and large ignored by the American people. And they did it, and they lost their lives facing the very same risks that we on the active duty side would face throughout our careers. And to speak to the title, the truth about reservists is that they're every bit the Marines that we are. Not everyone, just like not every active duty Marine is worth a damn, you know. But the good Marines that I met in the reserves were the best of us, you know. And we as a country owe those three Marines and their families, you know, a debt of gratitude. But we as a country owe all of the Marines and service members that are serving in combat zones around the world a little more attention than we're giving them, you know?
So do you have a solution to that, or are you just expressing your lament? Let me give you one of my first experiences with reservists. I was a company commander out in 29 Palms, and I was I was supposed to go.
God bless you.
Yeah, I was supposed to, support, I want to say at CACS, and to be in support of a reserve battalion as they were, I can't remember what they were doing. So, you know, I meet, and, you know, I'm meeting with their CO, and then we're meeting with their NCOs and the guys who we're going to work with. And I'll tell you what, it was different. Their NCOs were older and I thought more mature than a lot of what you get on active duty. And I was like, holy shit, these are grown-ass men with responsible jobs as civilians, and they bring that same level of responsibility. And I want to say they're a little bit older. And I was like, wow, what an interesting thing. I mean, older, more mature NCOs. I mean, for those of you who don't know, the Marine Corps is 60% of Marines are under the age of 26. And we turn over a third of the Marine Corps, right, I think, on an annual basis.
And it's important to note that the Marine Corps gives you a leadership role far earlier in your career than most other branches. You know, in the Marine Corps, as an E4, as a corporal, you're a non-commissioned officer. In the Army, that's not the case. You know, in the Army, you can become a corporal, you know, rather than a specialist. You're still not really considered a non-commissioned officer until you undergo specific training in order to be one. The Marine Corps emphasizes small unit leadership from boot camp forward. You know, I was a squad leader all through boot camp, and I would argue the lessons that were instilled in me through that absolutely informed the way that I led Marines as a young lance corporal. It absolutely informed I picked up corporal pretty quickly, and I would credit the experience I had behind me leading in what were, to me at the time, probably the most stressful situations I had faced yet, that helped me in that role. I'm not saying that other branches necessarily do it wrong. I think that they do, but, you know, I'm obviously biased. But the Marine Corps expects these very young men and women to lead other young men and women in incredible circumstances.
Right.
You know? But,
and I'll tell you, so that was my kind of first introduction to Marines on active duty that were, or reserve Marines that had been activated and were doing their thing. And I was really impressed with their level of professionalism. And then I served with 125 in Fallujah in 2006. They were
I'm very familiar with 125. I'm good friends with their former admin chief.
Yeah, and so I got to see them in pretty trying circumstances on a daily basis. And they were great. They were as good as any, you know, as other active duty units. And again, I know active duty units guys will roll their eyes like, Mac, you're just saying that. No, I'm not. Right?
And I think it's important that there is a distinction here between sometimes reserve elements may not, you know, you may be augmented to a reserve element or a reserve element may be augmented to you. And it's important to draw a distinction between if you've got concerns or issues with the way that their command trained them coming out versus the Marine that they are, you know, and I could write a book about criticisms. I have about some elements of the reserve command structure.
I would submit to you, though, Alex, that they're not a whole lot different between the two. I mean, they're Marines.
That's fair.
They go through boot camp just like we do when they're activated, mobilized, and have time to spend studying, you know, what you want them to do.
Exactly, yeah, I agree.
I would tell you, there's not – I don't remember at any time, and I'm just thinking about it now – I don't remember any time during that deployment thinking, yeah, well, these guys are reservists and they don't know what they're doing. Because the Marine Corps, I thought, did a pretty good job of sending them out to Mojave Viper and letting them get the same reps everybody else got. And so
therein lies some of my concerns, is that when money gets tight in the reserve world, one of the first things that go are the number of days that you'll be activated, you know, and so we've definitely deployed Marines as an augment that didn't go through the workups with the unit they were deploying with and things like that. And that I have an issue with. I don't fault the individual Marine for that. That's overall command structure concerns. But if you ask me at the boots on the ground level, you know, when you're talking about those reserve Marines, by and large, I mean, I've known plenty of active duty guys that were not worth a damn, and I've known plenty of reserve Marines that were not worth a damn, but I have known some incredible Marines in both component codes.
Right. No, I'm with you. I was impressed, and again, the bottom line is, we couldn't do it without the reserves. I mean, because
absolutely, man.
The reserves have hopped in there and done rotations, you know, as battalions. They've augmented.
You know, and some of these guys, some of these guys are cops that worked 70 hours this week, you know, and then they come in on Friday night, head out to the field with us to come home on Sunday. They go home on Sunday, get one good night's sleep, and then go back and work another 70 hours as a cop or a firefighter or a teacher, you know. These guys are the lifeblood of their communities. These guys and girls are the lifeblood of their communities. So in a certain way, when an active duty Marine dies, it's tragic, just as it is when a reserve Marine dies. But for the community, it almost hits the community harder when a group of reserve Marines pass away, because there's – I mean, in this case, all three of those gentlemen came from different towns and cities. But in a place like 25th Marine Regiment, if all three of the Marines passed away, they're all from South Boston. They're all three cops from South Boston.
Right.
That's going to have reverberating effects throughout the community,
right.
You know, in a way that we tend not to think about over on the active duty side, because whatever side you're on, you tend to think is the toughest go, right? And whatever it is that you're doing, you tend to think of as the best thing you could do. Active duty Marines make incredible sacrifices to do their jobs, but reserve Marines really do too.
Email. Good grief, Mac. Most states do not register guns. Your perception is due to living in the People's Republic of California. Add New Jersey, New York, and Maryland to the states that do not trust its citizens and require registration. I bought 4 guns in Ohio in the last 14 days with no registration.
I mean, I wouldn't advertise that, but but I
really.
I mean,
how many states require guns to be registered? You know what? He's exactly right. I grew up, and they were always registered in the state of California. I think.
Living in Connecticut, I'm not sure, to be honest. That was before the Marine Corps when I lived in Connecticut, so I only owned a shotgun. But
that doesn't count.
Yeah, well, in Vermont, I'll tell you, in Vermont, I mean, up until recently, Vermont has passed some pretty strict gun laws as of late. But when I was growing up in Vermont, the only gun laws in Vermont were like the federal guidelines. I bought my first gun in the parking lot of my high school. It was a shotgun. I bought it out of my buddy's trunk. And we didn't hide it. We weren't being sneaky. I mean, this is a product of our time. I'm old, right? But we weren't being sneaky about it. You know, he popped the trunk open, took his 12-gauge out. It was a 12-gauge breech loader, single shot. You know, he gave it to me. I gave him $50 or whatever. You know, I threw the shotgun in the trunk of my Mustang, closed it up, and kept it there. You know, and that's where my shotgun lived. It was in the trunk of my car.
Vermont's
a different place. You know?
Everybody should have a shotgun in the trunk of their car, you know.
Well, when you live in the woods of Vermont, having a shotgun in your trunk's not the worst idea.
Well, how about the woods how about the woods of Georgia?
You know, I'll say now that I live in suburbia,
right.
I feel a little overprepared.
The question was about the woods of Georgia, not about the suburbia of Georgia. I mean,
I'll tell you, I've had to kill more wildlife in Georgia than I ever did in Vermont. But I think that might be because I'm an older man now. When I lived in Vermont, I was a high school kid that I didn't care if possums were ransacking my trash cans and, you know, going after the cats. You know what I mean? When I lived in Vermont, I didn't care about, you know, things like that. But here in Georgia, I'm like, I don't want to clean up this trash, and these possums keep tearing my trash apart. So I've had campouts to go after coyotes or possums just because they're pests. That's something I never dealt with in Vermont, but maybe it was just because I was a kid, you know? I don't know. But I tell you what, Georgia's got a problem when it comes to, like, possums, coyotes, things that would love to eat my wife's little chihuahua.
That pisses me off. I mean, there's people around the corner from me that have all these shrubs in their front yard. It's like naturally landscaped, which means they don't take care of it very well, right? And so you have all these shrubs, and come around the corner at night, where do you think the coyote's lurking? In those shrubs.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, let me just tell you what isn't happening in my backyard, right? Jack or Joe being eaten by a coyote, so... I don't like those mangy things. And
I'm not a coyote fan, man. I lost a cat to a coyote.
Yeah,
a
I don't like that.
Ago.
You can't eat like the neighborhood animals. I don't like that. Don't
yeah, know. You know. I mean, here in this neighborhood, you'll hear coyotes, but I haven't seen any yet.
I was listening to
man.
This.
I've got possums around here like crazy, and I can't shoot them here. So I'm trying. You know, I'm looking for other
gotta
alternate
get,
solutions.
Yeah, you know? tase them. Then just tase them, then strangle them. The
soft garrot.
I was walking Jack. This is years ago after I came back from Afghanistan in San Diego, and I walk him down a hill, and we're walking around a cul-de-sac, and the houses. The street kind of drops off. So at the end of the cul-de-sac, there's no homes. So I'm walking him. You know, there's a big tree. Looks like an oak tree. Although I don't know if they have oak trees in San Diego. But anyway, it looked like an oak tree. And there's brush around it. And so I'm kind of walking in the, you know, off the street into the kind of woods area. And I see something motion kind of catches my eye. And I look, but there's nothing there. And, you know, my dog's got one of those, it's a retractable leash, so he's kind of, you know, I don't know, he might be 15 feet away from me, and out of this bush jumps a coyote. And
that's
has...
ballsy, man. I'm
yeah,
telling.
Has Jack's head in his mouth when I punted the son of a bitch, and then ran down the hill to strangle it, because I'd just come home from Afghanistan. I wasn't real happy with it. And the son of a bitch ran. So he then shattered us. As we continued our walk, Jack, like, lost his mind because he almost got ate. He had a near-death experience. And he was in that kind of post-near-death euphoria craziness thing. So he was losing his mind. I was losing my mind. So we both calmed down. We head up the hill. And who do you think following us up the hill?
No shit.
Yeah.
See, this is what I mean, because I've run into black bear all the time, you know, and I was asked recently, what do you do when you run into a black bear on the trail? Almost never anything. You know, almost every time I've ever seen a bear, the bear's been like, oh, shit, and gets the hell out of there. Coyotes, on the other hand, possums, they'll attack you. They will stand their ground, bare their teeth, and, you know, and hiss at you. In a way that no bear I've ever seen. I suppose maybe a grizzly or a brown bear. I haven't run into one of those, fortunately. But the only animal I've ever seen that demonstrates the sheer confidence of a coyote is a moose. It's the only other thing I've ever seen that'll stand its ground like that. You know, So if there's a coyote in my yard, I'm going to shoot it.
Yeah, I don't like coyotes. I think they're mangy, nasty. You know, they're like they remind me of the hyenas in Lion King.
Yeah, you know, and my pets, you know, so we have one cat that my wife found in the engine bay of our car at a grocery store, so she couldn't help but keep it. And so we have one fairly young kitten that my daughter does adore. But our other two pets are, you know, we've got a 13-year-old barn cat and a 14-year-old chihuahua.
Oh.
I don't have pets that can defend themselves against coyotes. You know, they're a couple old men that just like to lay around on the deck. You know,
yeah, they're not bothering anybody. And the last thing I want to do is come home, right, to a pile of fur.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Or
I
had a Shih Tzu who was very, very old. He was my mom and dad's dog when I first left for the Marine Corps, you know, way back when. And then my parents split up and so on and so forth and whatever. By the time I ended up coming back, this dog had no place to live. You know, he was a stinky old Shih Tzu. So I adopted him. Like, I don't know how to take care of one of these fancy dogs. You're supposed to, like, take him to the groomer all the time and stuff like that. So his name was Thor. That poor dog spent the last
what?
4 or 5 years of his
wait
life.
A minute, wait a minute. Thor?
Thor, the Shih Tzu. I did not name him. Yeah. He, as he got closer to the end of his life, you know, he was blind, he didn't have any teeth, and he kept wandering off into the woods, which from what I understand is, you know, something that dogs tend to do when it's their time, you know? And I was too stupid to let him, you know, because, you know, he was my dad's dog.
Right.
You know, I mean, he's like 17 years old, he's part of the family.
He's a part of the family than you are.
Yeah, you know, like, I did say that to my wife at one point. I was like, he's been with me longer, you know? I'm going to take care of this dog until he passes away.
I have to. You don't understand.
Yeah. You know, I carried him in my backpack on hikes just so that, like, I could let him out and wander around a little bit. He couldn't make it very far, so I put him back on the backpack and, keep on going. But he was running away from coyotes, or at least heard coyotes and was blind, you know, and was running away, ran right off the retaining wall in my old property and broke his back. And he's a 17-year-old dog who was blind and had no teeth and was doing bad anyway. But having to put that dog down was one of the hardest things I have ever had to do in my life, you know. And although I didn't see any coyotes, I know it was when we heard the coyotes whooping that he started running off. So I harbor a lot of ill will towards those bastards, you know.
For good reason.
Yeah. So I honestly don't love killing anything, you know. I don't feel great about killing anything. I have reveled a little bit in camping out in my yard and putting down coyotes. I'll admit that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people do. They hate coyotes. All right, let me ask you about this headline. Russia still sucks at not sucking.
that was just my note for you.
All right.
I don't even remember which story that was. What's the link for that one?
Russia may scrap its only aircraft carrier to avoid the embarrassment of towing it around the globe. Tell me about.
Yeah, so Russia's got a single aircraft carrier. It's the Admiral, I'll mispronounce this to save my life, Kuznetsov or whatever the hell. So this single aircraft carrier is actually the same basic frame as China's one operational aircraft carrier. They were both built in Ukraine prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, or at least the hulls were. So this carrier, you know, it's a diesel-powered carrier that has been troubled for decades. You know, it travels nowhere in the world without an accompanying ocean-going tugboat, just so that when it breaks down, it doesn't get stranded. This is how shitty Russia's only aircraft carrier is. So last year, it was in dry dock, which is a floating dry dock. Russia's one of two only floating dry docks that are large enough to support a vessel that size. I think it's 80,000 tons, 75,000 tons. The dry dock caught on fire and sank with the carrier on it. So as the dry dock sank, its crane collapsed onto the flight deck of the carrier, carrying a pretty big hole in the flight deck. The carrier itself stayed afloat while the dock sank. Here's the problem that Russia runs into. Before the dry dock sank, they had just finished taking the propellers off of the carrier, which means it has no form of propulsion under its own power whatsoever. You can't put new propellers on this carrier without putting it in a dry dock. And the only dry dock Russia has access to that could support this carrier is on the other side of the globe. They would need to go up and out of the ocean that they're in, all the way back down around the southern tip of Africa, and all the way back up and around through the Pacific to Russia's Pacific coast, you know, in the northern Pacific. We're talking about literally having to parade this aircraft carrier and tugboats around the entire planet in order to try to get it operational again, when Russia can barely afford to make it operational in the first place. So now they're faced with this question. Do we parade our horrible and embarrassing failure around the planet just to throw it in a dry dock for what will probably be close to a decade, you know, 5-6 years minimum, just to get it operational again when this thing is not in good shape to begin with? Or they could just scrap it and use the money that they had earmarked for updating this carrier for some of their other programs, like, for instance, the T-14 Armada, which is their new tank that's supposed to be decent. They just can't afford to buy any. Or the Su-57, their new fighter jet that's probably not that good, but they can't afford to buy any. Russia can't afford to buy anything. So they could really use that money for other initiatives. But to do that, they will lose the prestige of being one of the few nations on this planet with an operational aircraft carrier. As silly as it sounds, that's a big deal for Russia, because their big push is for foreign military sales, foreign weapon sales. And it's important for them that they can stay at the forefront of all these conversations. That's why they're investing in hypersonic missiles.
Yeah, but everybody knows you have to stay in their wheelhouse, okay? We don't go to Russia for aircraft carriers or ships, pretty much, all right?
That's a fair statement, but right. It's important that Russia is able to demonstrate force projection capabilities.
Oh, listen to you from the Brookings Institute, Alex Hollings. Say that again. Force projection?
It's important for Russia that they could demonstrate the ability to have force projection capabilities in places like Syria, because otherwise you're a country like China. China is only a threat in China's neighborhood. China, they've got the biggest standing army in the world and no way to transport them. The only way you go to war with China's army is if you land in China.
Yeah, but again, what is the purpose of China's army?
I mean, I think that they're working on that right now themselves, to be perfectly
fair. I'll give you the solution. It's to control the population of the nation of China.
That's a fair statement.
Right? It is not. We always say, well, we're so used to, right? Our paradigm is this, right? Our military is prepared to fight our wars and essentially head overseas. China the first rule is the Vito Corleone school of power. Sustain power at all costs. Rule number two, refer to rule number one in all other cases.
That actually speaks directly to the trouble China's having, in that it was only recently that they decided they wanted to make their military an actual global presence. Up until recently, China's military was largely symbolic. You know, high-ranking officials would pass their title to their sons. You know, you weren't appointed to a lot of these roles. You got there by familial relation, you know.
I love that.
There's rampant, the word's escaping me now. But the way that the Chinese military was operated for a very long time.
I think nepotism is what you were searching.
Nepotism is a good example. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Corruption is what I was looking for. Rampant corruption throughout the Chinese military. Still, there's still a great deal of it, but to Xi Jinping's credit, he's weeded a great deal of it out with this reorganization and modernization effort. But for a long time, the military was very much just a means of having power within China. It had very little to do. I mean, they had a massive military, so they didn't have to worry too much about invasion, but in the modern world, didn't have to worry too much about that anyway. It was much more a means of having social, political, and economic power within China, right? Only recently did they start turning the focus of the military outward. And now they're facing a lot of hurdles. You know, China's, they do have a dozen J-20s. They've got 12 fifth-generation fighters. But they've also got horses still. You know, we're talking about a nation, the disparity between their most advanced military technology and their least advanced technology is astonishing. You know, they're not a modern military power like the United States sees itself. They're working towards it. They really are. But right now, China's you know, green force navy, which means they really, really can only operate within a few hundred miles of friendly ports. You know, they couldn't go to war with the American, you know, West Coast. That's what Russia wants to maintain, is this idea of being a blue force navy, a global navy. China doesn't have that currently.
A blue water navy. And Alex is right. That's a big deal. You know, power projection and challenging the United States on a world, you know, on the world stage. You know,
because it's important for people to remember, it's not about who would win a fight. Very little of geopolitics is about who would win a fight. It's mostly about who could posture well. Who can manipulate the perceptions of the people and the lawmakers that are making these decisions, you know?
And that is, and we all know that's Dr. Evil's, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's his stock and trade.
Absolutely. And so Vladimir Putin trades.
It doesn't matter.
His ability to manipulate perceptions.
It doesn't matter if we have to tow it everywhere. Okay? So we'll tow it. Right? We'll still have an airport that we can take off and we can park that in the med and we'll leave it there. So screw off.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is Russia could not economically support going to war with the United States, let alone NATO. They couldn't manage it financially. But we're still constantly talking about how worried we are about new Russian defense initiatives. In part, I argue, because it's important that we keep an eye on 50 years from now. And the way to do that is to pay close attention to today. But also in part because they're very good at convincing us that they're a military power.
Right.
They're really not. You know, China is a much more formidable opponent economically, diplomatically, military-wise, if you're in the area, if you're in the Pacific, maybe not so much in the Atlantic. But what Russia's really – that's why they come out with these doomsday weapons. It's a way to keep themselves relevant in the conversation. It's a way to keep perception that they're a global power that you really need to be worried about. In all honesty, what does a 100-megaton nuke do that, you know, two 50-megaton nukes can't do? Nothing. You know, Russia's ICBMs are already overwhelmingly more powerful than America's.
Yeah,
Russia already has more nuclear weapons than we have. They didn't need the Status 6 submarine nuke. They got it. They built it literally just so that we'd write about it, just so we'd all worry about it. You know, it's a good strategy. It works.
Yeah, but really, come on. Nobody's nuking anybody, so it's not like, okay,
exactly.
It works.
Mutually assured destruction doesn't change when you paint the nukes a new color.
Exactly. All right, what are you writing this week?
Well, right now I'm working on Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson. Recently was speaking at the Space Symposium talking about how America may well end up demonstrating some orbital weapons in the near future in order to make sure national opponents like China and Russia are aware that we have the means to defend ourselves. There's two really important factors to this. She didn't give any more details. The first one is America signed the Outer Space Treaty in 1967. The Outer Space Treaty is actually something like the treaty on principles governing the activities of states in the exploration and use of outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies. I'm reading that. That's the real name of the treaty, the Outer Space Treaty. We signed it in 67, so did Russia, so did China, so did 105 other countries.
And?
And one of the requirements is you're not allowed to deploy weapons in space. You know, so.
Oh, okay. So we know
now,
everybody else plays by all these treaties like
we do. Of course. You know, China and Russia already have autonomous mobile platforms in space that we believe are weapons.
What a shock.
Know? What a shock, right? And to be fair, America has the X-37B or 47B, the drone space shuttle the Air Force operates for hundreds of days at a time in orbit, that feasibly could also have, you know, weaponized capabilities. The loophole in the treaty is that you're allowed to put defensive platforms in orbit. So as long as America can paint this as we're putting something there to defend against missiles, for instance, or defend our satellites against attack, we really might be able to get away with it without violating the terms of the treaty, but there's going to be a great deal of diplomatic fallout. Russia and China already want to paint the Space Force initiative as America militarizing space, even though Russia and China already have military branches dedicated to space. It's all about perceptions, right? And so this
it's about cock blocking the United States, because it's like, look, the last thing Putin needs is the United States turning to on hypersonic weapons, okay? Remember, he's got his economy is the size of Canada's.
Exactly. And just imagine, here in the United States, with so many Americans that are animately opposed to any initiative that Donald Trump champions, seeing these headlines about China's president says America's militarizing space with the Space Force. Russia's president says America is militarizing space with its Space Force. Or they'll say Trump is militarizing space with his Space Force. And if you're a person who already doesn't like Donald Trump, it's really easy for that to sway you towards the idea that a Space Force is not required. A Space Force is not something we have to do. And if anything, America's being the aggressor here. The truth of the matter is, and I think Heather Wilson said it well, I don't know if it was at that symposium or in front of the Senate Armed Forces Committee last week, but she basically said, we built glass houses before the invention of rocks. Now China and Russia are deploying rocks. India's shooting down satellites. You know, now people have rocks. We need to find a way to defend these glass houses that we already have in place. And she and I might not see eye to eye on the best ways to do that, but I think that she's 100% right. We're playing catch-up, but these governments are projecting it as though we're the aggressor in space. And for your average American that may not be that attuned to what's going on in the NatSec discussion, it would be easy for them to believe that America's leading the way in making space into a battle space, when the truth of the matter is we're just trying to defend the stuff we've got. You know, so we're gonna be seeing number one, some inflammatory headlines in the next couple of weeks, but number two, this is an opportunity that we will see Russian and Chinese officials take advantage of. They're going to try to take Heather Wilson's statements and twist it into something that can paint America in a bad light. So it's good to be cognizant of that before the wave ensues.
All right, sir. First of all, tell everybody where they find your work.
Well, you can find me on Facebook, on facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. You can find me on Twitter at AlexHollings52. You can find my stuff all over the Internet. I'm on NewsRep. I'm on Popular Mechanics. Hunt me down on social media.
There you go. Hunt him down everywhere. Alex Hollings. All right, bud. Thanks for the visit.
Thanks a lot for your time, man.
All right, I'll be in touch. There you have it, the one and only Alex Hollings here on a Monday morning. More of Auburn Radio. We'll wrap things up. Coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255. And press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it. 2 hours today. Could do a little experiment here. As All Marine Radio gets bigger and bigger. So have a great day. Don't touch that dial. If you missed the first hour, check out news headlines. And you're going to hear me read a letter. The identity of the person is not revealed, but I try to share that stuff when I get it, because I think it gives you some sense of, I mean, something that this program does is save lives now. And I can't tell you what it, I mean, I don't think I need to tell you. If you listen to the show, you get that. And so so don't touch that dial. You'll hear that email, and then check out some news headlines on a day that, after a couple weeks, back in the studio again, and it's nice. So we'll do this for a couple weeks before head out again back to Quantico and see what else life brings. So anyway, thanks for listening on a Monday. Remember, download those two goals and eight commandments to your phone and just forget about them. And I promise you, you'll change somebody's life just by having them there. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.